Homage to the Buddha, homage to the Dharma, homage to the Sangha. Welcome, everybody. This scares me. I have to put that down. This is going to be kind of an interesting Dharma talk, I think. Not quite sure where we're going to end up. So the Buddha once said that his teaching was not supposed to be a description of everything. It was just a description of what we needed. And there's a scene where he's with Ananda and he picks up a handful of autumn leaves and he says, I have given you a handful of truths, but besides these there are many thousands of other truths that cannot be numbered. So one of the handful of truths he gave us was called dependent origination. And don't worry, this is not a talk about dependent origination. Dependent origination says that the nature of existence is change, that constant coming into being is the nature of everything. And the formula is very simple. In the Pali Canon, it appears multiple times, and one of them is this being that becomes. From the arising of this, that arises, and so on and so forth. This not being, that does not become. From the ceasing of this, that ceases. And to some scholars and practitioners, dependent origination is really the Buddhist theory of everything, because it explains how everything arises. The unified field theory of Dharma. But it's a maddening teaching. And if you're looking for a satisfying creation story, you are not going to find it there. Later on in the 5th through the 13th or so common era, Mahayana Buddhism developed something called the fivefold niyama. It was a commentary form. That means the natural laws of Buddhism. Niyama has a lot of meanings, but one of them is constraint or necessity or inevitability, as well as law. So the five inevitabilities of existence. And they were first developed as a skeleton for dependent origination, as a way to explain how dependent origination works. But then they spread as a separate teaching and became the matter of a lot of debate and interpretation. It's kind of turned into this, like how many angels can dance on the head of a pin for Buddhism. And it's still, I discovered, a matter of ongoing scholarly dispute, exactly. But that's very nice because that allows me to interpret them and you to interpret them. So, but dispute or not, it is really useful to look at these laws and see what is supposedly included in Dharma, right? What is, for a very, very long time, been considered to be part of Dharma. Which means truth. How does Dharma see the universe itself? Where does Dharma fit in this universe? Or where does the universe fit in Dharma? The first law, Uta Niyama, is simply all the physical laws of the universe. The second law, Bija Niyama, is all the organic laws of the universe, how life arises. The third law, Citta Niyama, is consciousness and psychic phenomena, mental formations, perceptions, and thought. The fourth law, Kama Niyama, cause and effect. Karma is cause, its fruits are the effects. And then the fifth law, Dhamma Niyama, is the law of perfection, that all things move toward enlightenment. Kind of includes everything. So I want to break these down a little bit and be kind of amazed at the world for a while, okay? The universe is just astounding, and I never get tired of looking at it. This talk kind of started a couple years ago during the lockdown when I read a book called Fundamentals by a Nobel Prize-winning physicist, astrophysicist named Frank Wilczek. It's not an easy book, But he has these wonderful chapter titles like, There's Plenty of Space, and There's Plenty of Time, and There Are Just a Few Laws. And then he goes deeply into physics and mathematics to show you what it means that there's plenty of space and plenty of time. One thing he emphasizes is that the universe is what he calls fundamentally simple. There are a few ideally simple parts, just a few, and four forces or interactions. And that's everything. Our entire genome is made out of a few proteins. And only a few particles create those proteins. He says, we are mass, charge, and spin. That's what you are, that's what I am, mass, charge, and spin. But how about this? Each human body contains far more atoms than there are stars in the visible universe. Each human body has 10 octillion atoms. And you probably know some of this. The nucleus of an atom, the nucleus contains 99% of the mass. But in terms of volume, it is one part in a million of one part in a billion. That's how much mass there is in an atom. So the physical universe doesn't actually have much in it. Most things in it don't have any mass at all. And that includes our bodies. We feel so bounded. We feel so bound physically. But we are almost entirely space. And yet that tiny, tiny little nucleus weighs more than the sum of its parts. Nobody knows why. But perhaps the most important discovery of subatomic physics is not that atoms are made of parts. For a law, atom means that the word atom comes from a word that means that it can't be separated. But it turns out it can. But that fields are the fundamental building blocks. And I'll come back to fields. Everything in the universe is particles and fields. And they're kind of the same thing. Particles are the manifestation of a force. And forces are exerted by the qualities of a particle. So they give and take all the time. This does have dharmic resonance. So we feel so bounded. I looked up, what is the average vertical leap of a human being? Guess how far most human beings, the average leap of a healthy adult is 1 foot. A vertical leap. That's how far off the ground we can get on our own power. That's how we are so bound, matter to matter, and yet we are mostly space. We are mostly vibrating fields, interwoven fields, interacting fields. And thinking about things like this, I've discovered, because I like to think about things like this, I find it very consoling. It can also be very scary for some people to consider this. The French mathematician Blaise Pascal, he said, the universe grasps me and swallows me up like a speck. And you can either think, yeah, or no. The second law, the organic laws. Again, how tiny we are and how large we are. Whitman's, we contain multitudes. First, outside of our body. In a teaspoon of soil, there are more living organisms than human beings on Earth. We think we're so special. There are 10 quintillion insects on Earth right now. And I love this one. By weight, there are 12 times as many ants as people. By weight. 17 million flies for every person. It's a lot of flies. And flies are really important. There are more bacteria on this planet than stars in the visible universe. And yet, we are so big. Each human brain contains as many neurons as there are stars in the Milky Way. 100 billion neurons, which is hundreds of millions of miles, by the way. Millions of miles of neurons just here. And all of this happened very fast. We are a very young race. In the entire history of the human race, there have been 10,000 generations, which is equal to about 5,000 lifetimes. So 5,000 steps backward, and we don't exist. Pretty fast evolution. So we accept all these physical laws. We accept all these organic laws. What's left? Consciousness. All the psychic formations, all our mental formations, perceptions, thoughts, emotions. It really starts to get interesting in here that we have a law that says these things exist. Because it's describing something which isn't measurable in the material world by the tools we have now. It's visible, but not measurable. That's what's interesting. We see it functioning all the time, and in fact, it sees itself. It is the tool with which we see it. And it takes me to Dogen, who says, we are always leaping out of emptiness. We are always leaping out of and returning to emptiness. In terms of particles are manifestations of forces, and we are a manifestation of emptiness. We just appear out of emptiness. Now, Frank Vilcek, he's a physicist, so he's very interested in consciousness. And he says it shouldn't be. Shouldn't exist. In terms of conventional physics, consciousness is impossible. The idea of a self, an I, that can exert control over a physical universe is antithetical to the atom, which requires matter to exert force on matter. But he notes it's perfectly legitimate in a world of fields to always remember that we are fields. And I want to point out that space itself is also a field. Space can be deformed. Space can curve. A physicist says space is stiff because it's hard to curve it, but it can be curved, and it quivers. Vilcek predicts that we'll find space particles one of these days. So we just live continually in this world of fields. The fourth law is karma. So, the universe is fundamentally simple, right? But simple fundamentals does not lead to simple results. I like this quote. Vilcek says, the history of Sweden is more complicated than the history of the universe. Because it's just clearly one quantum mechanical wave function after another. But he notes that a quantum mechanical wave function contains a great deal of information. And so he calls the universe a combinatorial explosion of combinatorial explosions. So you start with one, and it just builds. This happens, and then that happens. We're back to dependent origination, do you see? This arises, and thus that arises. And each arising leads to infinitely more arisings, combining explosions. So a subtle difference in one place can lead to an extremely different result somewhere else. And an identical event somewhere else will lead to a completely different result because of what follows. So I thought about a tsunami wiping out a coastal town. One cause is the movement of tectonic plates. But that doesn't say very much, really. As the planet formed, the plates were created. So we go back to a further arising. Eventually, oceans arose. Inevitably, these plates would have to shift and a great wave would come. But what caused the planet to form in that way? Why did the planet form there, where water could arise? You go back and back and back, and you can't ever find the beginning. Vast numbers of prior causes to every effect. Each is simple in itself and leads to complicated effects. This is totally true in your own life. You think you know the cause of what happened to you today, but find the cause of that and the cause of that, and it goes back infinitely into the past, infinitely complex. This law also explains that humans evolved, lots of little combinatorial explosions there, and made cities along that coast. And maybe they discovered nuclear power and decided it was a good place to put a nuclear reactor. And karma decided, karma explains why one person went for a walk on the beach that day, and another person went for a hike in the mountains. And the effects of those choices will lead to new effects in the future. Each cause leading to new effects. And this happens on a grand scale and a microscopic scale all the time. So we are forces continually shifting. Vilcek says, very slight tweaks to the early history of the solar system. What is a very slight tweak to the solar system? Can make the difference between an asteroid that impacts Earth and kills off the dinosaurs and one that misses. Would be a different planet if that asteroid hadn't hit. And it made me think about what would be a tiny tweak in my past that would mean I was not here today, had never been here today, had never been in this building, had never found this path, or had gone a completely different direction. Think of those tiny little tweaks. But then we have the fifth law, the law of enlightenment. This was explained to me by my teacher as everybody's doing the best they can, which is hard to believe. It's very hard to believe at times, but I think it's very important to remember that. We are very judgmental about other people's choices, and we look out at the world and the suffering in the world, and we think, why don't they behave differently? Why don't they make different decisions? If we realize that people are really working with what they have out of their own woundedness and their own deformity and their own brokenness and doing the best they can do out of that, it takes a lot of the heat out of my anger to realize that. It's not good enough, but it's the best they can do. Those two things can be true. So this law says everything is moving toward enlightenment. Everything is always tending toward perfection, is another translation. Here's a quote. A human being is part of a whole called the universe, a part limited in time and space. He experiences himself, his thoughts, and feelings as something separated from the rest, a kind of optical delusion of his consciousness. This delusion is a kind of prison for us. That was said by Einstein. He was somebody who looked up from these amazing facts about the universe and saw the wars and the suffering and the loss and said, why? And he said, the delusion of separateness is what causes this. So back to space, which is a field that quivers and shifts. It's so, such abundance. Everything by far in the universe, by a great difference, is space. And yet, even though the universe seems to share these few fundamental blocks, as far as we can see, it's the same fundamental building blocks. As far as we can see, which is actually quite far at this point, it's the same laws and the same particles. But things don't look the same. And in physics, that's called complementarity. Complementarity is the concept that any single thing can seem to have very different, even contradictory qualities when it's seen from a different perspective. Does that sound familiar? We'd call it Indra's net. Indra's net is a net across the universe, and every knot in the net is a jewel that reflects every other knot, which means every other bit of matter, but also every other moment of time. Everything reflected in everything each jewel containing all of space and time. But we see such a tiny bit. We just see a kind of tiny fraction of a brief reflection of things. Dogen's words, "This universe is a fragment of the red heart, and space is contained within the hollow of the hand." Imagine that all of this space is also just a part of something. And finally, most of the universe can't be perceived at all. Most of everything seems to consist of what we call dark energy and dark matter, which cannot be measured by any tool we have or can even imagine. All we can do is measure what is missing from what we see. And dark matter and dark energy don't even seem to interact with us much at all. So we seem to occupy this little, like, 4% of the universe. And all the rest of it, we can't even conceive of it. I like to think that this fifth law of all things tending toward enlightenment is Dharma dark matter. Because all we know is what is missing, right? That missing piece seems so foreign and so out of reach and so far from most of us. We can't even measure it. We can't locate it. We don't know what it is or where it is. There's another astrophysicist named Rebecca Elson who wrote poems, and I'm going to read one of her poems in a minute. This is how she explains dark matter. "It is as if all there were fireflies, and from them you could infer the meadow." And that, to me, that is such a dharmic statement. We see a firefly and we guess there's a meadow somewhere. That's how we begin to practice. That's how we begin the investigation. What is that firefly? Where is it going? Where is it from? Enlightenment seems so far from our ordinary practice, but it fills this great abundant space. And it moves through us constantly, but we don't even notice that it's moving through us. We don't seem to interact with us. So all we can do is look for the meadow, right? Follow tiny points of light and find the meadow. And there are a lot of fireflies. They are very abundant. I'm going to end with this other poem by Rebecca Elson called "Antidote to Fear of Death." "Sometimes, as an antidote to fear of death, I eat the stars. Those nights, lying on my back, I suck them from the quenching dark till they are all inside me, pepper hot and sharp. Sometimes, instead, I stir myself into a universe still young, still warm as blood. No outer space, just space. The light of all the not-yet stars drifting like a bright mist, and all of us and everything already there, unconstrained by form. And sometimes it's enough to lie down here on earth beside the long ancestral bones, to walk across the cobble fields of discarded skulls, each like a treasure, like a chrysalis, thinking, whatever left these husks flew off on bright wings."
Thank you, Jiko. We now have a period for questions and comments. If you're in the Zendo, raise your hand and I'll bring the microphone to you. Please state your name so everyone can hear that. And if you are on Zoom, please type your question or comment in the chat box for it to be read aloud or your name to be unmuted. And we have a question in the Zendo.
And then let me just reiterate, Satan said, say your name, and also let's be kind of pithy and focused on the question. So, thanks.
This is Diamond, and you had a wonderful talk, and you had me at space time. But so I was thinking about that, the niyamas and time. Okay, it's where does time generally fit into that aspect, would you say?
Where would it fit in the niyamas?
Yeah.
I think it might be a complementarity. It depends on which way you're facing. Yeah. It's one of the physical laws, but it's also karma.
Because I was thinking that in one sense, because that's where we often get hung up, you know, in our perceptions of time. And like if we're sitting, boy, it's going long, or this or that, or our life as we get older, we think of time. But it really strikes me that time is an artificial construct that we impose upon the world, that it really is a physical or a mental construct. You know, that in one sense you could say that there is no time in and of itself. You know, that it is totally empty, of course.
Well, time in Buddhist terms is a very big topic, and I don't want to get too lost in there, but I think that one thing that fits into the context of what I'm saying today is that we each occupy a completely unique space and moment and at all times. Where you are sitting right now in this moment, nothing obstructs you, and there is no, and it's totally unique. And it will fall away, and there will be another being in another moment. We call that the time being.
Mm-hmm. Right? Dharma position.
Yeah, and then the Dharma position is your unique position. But to a physicist, time is that which expresses change. One physicist says it's what clocks measure. It's a very big topic, so I don't want to get too lost in that. But we have many relative ways of looking at time, that some of which can be very unuseful, unwholesome. But in a bigger sense, I think it's useful to remember that this moment right now has never been before and will never be again. And that includes you in it. And in that sense, everything matters so much. Everything is so precious.
Thank you.
This is Sage. What is a field?
In the metaphor I was using, the field is the awakened nature of all things, which includes you, Sage.
Okay. What is a field instead of a particle?
Oh, a field instead. I thought you meant the meadow.
Yeah, the meadow is lovely.
A field is the force exerted by a piece of matter. So gravity is a field because it's exerted by mass. That's what a field. A field is a non-physical force exerted by matter.
Okay, I'll try.
We use fields all the time. We're talking and thinking right now.
Can I just jump in with a bit more about fields? Never thought I'd be doing this. A field is another way of looking at both matter and forces, Sage. It's in some sense, fields are more fundamental than matter. A field is just a value at every point in the universe, every point in space. In fact, particles emerge, as it were, from fields. And so one tends to think of the universe of matter as made up of particles, bits of stuff, which are localized and point-like, right? But in fact, the more fundamental way of looking at both matter and forces is as of something that fills the whole of space with values at every point. That's what a physicist would say, and I'll shut up about that now because that's not really what we're here to talk about.
Thank you. This is Genko. So something came across the Cloud a Day email a few weeks back that just really struck me. The picture was of a rainbow, and it appeared that it was reflected in the water underneath it, and it was beautiful, and it said, that is not a reflection, because a rainbow doesn't have any substance or any mass to actually do that reflecting. That what we saw in the water was a separate light effect. And I was just really struck by that, because rainbows appear to be real. I mean, they look like they have something there. But it's just light, so maybe it's just because it's light that it has no mass. I just found that kind of mind-blowing, and it kind of fits in with some of this confusion that I think you're talking about.
Well, and I just decided we're not going to light today. Okay. We're not going to talk about time or photons or light or any of that, because I left a lot out of this.
Right, right.
Thank you. Another talk. And Dogen actually talked a lot about light and reflection and mirrors and radiance, and he's quite modern in what he says, what he gauged. That's one of the interesting things about comparing conventional Dharma and traditional sources to modern physics is they got a lot right as far as we can tell today. They were predicting quantum mechanics in a lot of different ways. So anyway, different talk.
Thank you.
This is Martha. I'm still trying to wrap my brain around the fact that I'm mostly space. And it feels like that should really have an impact on our practice. And so I'm trying to figure out what that impact is.
Oh, it did for me. One reason I come to this talk is way back in the old days, when I had no idea what he was talking about, Keoghan gave this lecture about Li and Shi, which is about relative and absolute and the Dharma Dhatus, and I'm not going to go try to explain that to you here, but I mean, I was listening to these words, and I knew they were mostly English, but I didn't know what he was talking about. But what he was talking about is how form does not obstruct form, and form does not obstruct emptiness, and emptiness does not obstruct form. That's just the way he's talking about it. Relative and the absolute don't obstruct each other. And I couldn't get my head around, how can form not obstruct form? I can hit you and obstruct you. And that was a real gateway for me, was all of a sudden one day I just saw us all as ghosts passing through each other. That there, in terms of this, like I was saying to Dainen, a unique body in a unique position in a unique place and moment, how could anything obstruct that? You are completely free in that moment. Nothing else can obstruct you. So that was to me partly understanding that we are almost all space. So we can occupy what seems like almost the same space and not obstruct each other. That can go at a lot of places from there, but that was my aha. And think about how, as being mostly space, your skin is permeable, the air moves in and out of your lungs. Everything in the world is moving in and out of our bodies all the time. We take the earth in, we excrete matter. It's completely always systematically spinning through us. Angie's had her hand up for quite a while.
I have a comment and a question. A comment, for how many, did you say 17 billion flies for every person, every human? Mm-hmm. And like, I was thinking, they do a really good job of staying away from us if there's that many.
17, I think so it's mad. 17 million.
Yeah. A single fly.
17 million flies. Well, flies are, I mean, I could talk for 2 hours about flies.
but that was my comment. But and my question is about consciousness. Is that the same as sentience? I don't remember, but I appreciate we Buddhists recognize more than humans are sentient beings. We want to save all sentient beings, and that fly is sentient. And you also made this comment from the physicist that, like, consciousness doesn't fit in that. where does this come? I've also been reflecting about language and how it seems to, I suspect it comes out of ritual. And I see my animals, like, they depend on ritual to communicate with me. They enjoy it.
Can you boil it down to one question?
The question is, like, and I guess we don't, like, the origin of consciousness, I guess independent origination, where does that origin of sentience or consciousness come from?
Well, I don't know. But at some point, some things combined and a force or field was created, which was consciousness. This law is saying that this is natural law of the natural universe, that consciousness naturally arises. And in physics terms, it, you know, one combining explosion after another suddenly leads to the conditions in which matter can exert a force, which can have a non-physical force that can have an effect on the material world. Right there is a non-physical force affecting the world. Mm-hmm. I tend to be very impatient with people who say that consciousness is a peculiarly human thing. No, that's just silly. But also, it's not a peculiarly Earth thing either. So we're just peculiarly narcissistic.
So this is Suho. So where's the debate then? You said earlier in your talk that there's debate among these laws seem encompassing and big, and they could take up a lot of stuff. So
I did not go too far down that road, because it really did. All of a sudden, I was like, oh, wait a minute. This is just scholarly nitpicking about what this word means and who said what when they said it. And it was just Dharma debate that wasn't very useful for me. Yeah. Got time for a couple, three more.
Good morning. This is Lotman. I cannot go back to undo yesterday. But for the time being, I'm anticipating the unfolding of the effects that's tomorrow. So now I'm in an in-between marginal space, and it's not very productive. It's not a question, but maybe you can give me some insight. So I don't want to be floating in between cause and effect, but I know what I did, and I know something's going to happen to me.
Mm-hmm.
But what do I do for now? Thank you.
Well, I would kind of reject the idea that you're floating between cause and effect, because your very existence is a cause. At all moments, there is a cause, which is you're there. You're breathing. That has an effect on the things around you. You take a step. That has an effect on the thing you stepped on. You can't avoid causing.
Okay.
There is often a gap between this cause and its specific fruit, and it can sometimes be a long gap. But it's not all that useful to try to work your way all the way back, because there's a cause before that, and a cause before that. The most important thing is to accept the effect when it arrives.
Okay. So something, maybe that's something I need to be learn how to do it.
Yeah.
But it's so exhausting. What I do something now, something going to happen to me later. Then maybe I say, no, I don't want to do anything.
So it can be quite exhausting to accept the fruits of our past behavior. Mm-hmm. So it should work as an influence to your present behavior. If we accept today's effect and we don't like it, maybe we will change and turn a little bit to change the effects of tomorrow.
Plant a seed and kind of like anticipate the enjoyment of the fruit.
Right. That's later. One thing we say about karma is if you want apples, you plant an apple tree. Okay. If you plant a pear, you're never going to get apples. Okay. So knowing what you're trying to create is helpful.
Enjoy the journey before the effect.
Enjoy the journey. Yeah.
This is Emily. I want you to tell me a little more about fireflies. So how do they show up in your life or your experience? Or how do you
You guys have heard me say this so many times, but you see somebody or something that has what you want, what's missing. For me, I came with anxiety and depression and a lack of stability, and I met a couple of people who seemed stable and happy, and they were fireflies. Where did you get that? Can I have some of that? Show me where the meadow is. That many different dark times in my practice, I would see a distant firefly. Oh, there is still some place I want to go. There is still a guide on this path somehow that will lead me to that meadow. Does that make sense? Yeah. Last call. One last call.